quantum computing and Bitcoin are both things that are necessary for us to develop and move forward as a civilization.
Are there certain Bitcoin addresses that are susceptible to quantum attacks versus some that aren't?
Eventually, I think people just get sick of trusting the government to have the fiscal responsibility not to overspend and deficit spend.
What stops Core 31, Core 32, any other from Core somewhat unilaterally deciding, here's what we're going to do? They've learned that with Core 30, they can kind of push it forward, and it doesn't really matter if everyone on X is screaming at them and saying, we don't want this.
Bitcoin sort of like gives you like permission to learn about like how banking works, how money works. And it really is like an amazing lens to view the world through. That's why I not only dedicated my career to working on it, but to also resolving one of the larger existential threats to it.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Hunter Beast. We go deep into quantum computing, how it's a threat to Bitcoin, what he and his team are working on to fix that. We touch on aliens as potentially the creator of Bitcoin. We touch on the knots versus core debate. It's all here. Really think you're going to enjoy this episode. It does get a bit dense, so hang in there. I think you're going to learn a lot from Hunter. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Hunter here. Hunter, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Hi, glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. So, Hunter, I told you, I want you to give a quick background on yourself, how you came into Bitcoin. I think it tends to be a more boring place to start. So I like to jump into more interesting things usually. But you're working on a very complex problem. I think it's important that people understand that you have credibility. You've been around the block. You have a lot of experience in tech. So why don't you just tell people who you are and, why we're going to be talking about this stuff today.
Yeah. Hi. So I've been working in tech for about 15 years now. And when I first came across Bitcoin, I didn't understand it. I actually touched on it a couple of times until eventually I had enough friends telling me that I needed to read the Bitcoin Standard. And I eventually just picked up that book and put the time into it and learned a lot about it. And I think that was a good primer for me at the time. And it just got me reflecting on the fact that the system is incredibly unfair. It is rigged to benefit the wealthy and powerful and at the expense of those who can least afford it. I think the system of central banking and credit creation, monetary expansion, yield, usury, REBA, RIBIT, whatever you want to call it. Like the whole system, we've been warned throughout history. Every civilization that has adopted and debased their a fiat currency, a weaker currency, has fallen, and we have this in our. We have rules against excessive money lending in our oldest and holiest sacred texts, and that we instead chose to go full on to a debt based money system. I think has had really terrible long lasting consequences on humanity, and I think That's why, Bitcoin is so important. And I think a lot about it, and I work on it now. I've dedicated my career to resolving one of the larger existential risks to Bitcoin. And it's interesting, the quantum FUD, because it's been around since at least 2012, at least for Bitcoin. So it's nearly since the very beginning, there's always been this concern that cryptography could be compromised by external factors. And then a year later, in 2013, Edward Snowden leaked the existence of a NSA program to build a quantum computer explicitly for the purpose of breaking cryptography. And it was called Penetrating Hard Targets. That was the code name for the program. and they were spending $80 million on it that year. And 12 years later, 13 now, almost, it's a very different world in terms of, you know, the theoretical applicability of that concern. So I think it's getting to the point where we really do need to start taking that seriously. And it's a very difficult to understand problem, because for a number of reasons, it's really like there's a lot to be said about that, but there's a lot of factors, including privacy and scalability and, you know, all sorts of things. And I chose to focus on solving that problem. It's this complicated problem that could benefit from my experience, and also it's crucial for us to solve.
So how comfortable would you feel giving like a very high level primer on quantum computing? How does it work? Why is it a threat to elliptic curve and probably other cryptography? And then we could talk about like the immediate impact on Bitcoin if it were to come to fruition.
Yeah. So quantum computers essentially harness physical phenomenon at a fundamental level that can sort of accelerate certain kinds of computation that can benefit from that. Some forms of computation, such as neural networks, for example, are probabilistic, and they map well to what's called quantum machine learning. Before we ever thought about that, though, there was a algorithm called Shor's algorithm that essentially makes use of constructive interference to accelerate finding sort of what they call periodicity, or like repeating patterns, I guess, in number problems that could be eventually on a decent enough powerful computer could potentially be used to break the essentially the security assumption that is used to justify the security behind elliptic curve cryptography. And these computers, by harnessing physical, like the fundamental physics, essentially, to accelerate computation of problems we used to think were nearly impossible to solve, instead, and there's a lot of caveats here, right? Because like if you look into, you know, where the technology is at now, the quantum computers are not competitive, and they probably might not be competitive for a very long time, but they might eventually be good enough to at least solve a 256-bit number. And right now they're maybe at like 5 or 6 bits, which, you know, like is not impressive at all in the slightest. I get that. But that said, if you have been following the field for long enough and you know its history, I mean, we're the farthest we've ever come. And I really do not want to bet like the lifeboat on the possibility that we won't be able to solve this problem with all the billions being poured into it from both the United States and China. So ultimately we need to take the problem seriously enough, even though the computers themselves right now are, at least on paper, and the ones that we know about, are not very impressive. They're impressive enough, I think, prudent for us to take the potential threat seriously and take active steps in adopting mitigations.
Yeah. Are there certain Bitcoin addresses that are susceptible to quantum attacks versus some that aren't? And if so, what's the distinction there?
Yeah. So the distinction is that so long as the public key is hashed, then it's a lot harder to, way harder. And to derive the private key from its public key. It's not impossible. And it might become a concern in the far future, but for now, I think the bigger problem is essentially any coins that are held in an address in which the public key has been revealed. There are four scenarios in which that happens on Bitcoin. The first and most notable one that everybody runs into is when they use Bitcoin is that whenever you sign a transaction, you need to publish your public key in order for the signature to be verifiable. And any transaction that's been signed by your wallet and submitted to the mempool is immediately vulnerable to what we call a short exposure attack. A short exposure attack, we make a big distinction between and long exposure attacks because the time limit, like 10 minutes or so, even an hour or even a day, could be too short for a quantum computer to work over without it being far more advanced than we understand them to be. And so, whereas if a quantum computer had all the time in the world and all the energy and all the money, then it's definitely a different problem. And so that's when we get at long exposure attacks. And so long exposure attacks essentially are when a public key has been available on chain for a long time. And so at that point, you know, you have to wonder if it's an economically motivated attacker, then they would go for the highest value address instead of, other things. But that's also gets into the problem of like game theory and who's at most at risk and that sort of thing, which is complicated because quantum computers are not really traditional computers in the fact that we consider computers to be pretty ubiquitous technology at this point, and not just solely within the hands of the U.S. government or government agencies. That's not the case for quantum computers. And in particular, even if there are private companies working in quantum computing, especially in the U.S., but also in China as well, we essentially have the Chinese equivalent of political officers in these companies, where they have a direct line to any company that's developing advanced technology is going to have a spook, basically, like a Fed working for them and keeping an eye on them. And so I think one of the more telling things we might see one day is if they ever decide to make that illegal, to make using advanced technology like quantum computing to attack things that are deeply rooted in financial markets, for example. And so I think that would be like a big red flag, and we need to step things up if we get agency directive like that. But we've had kind of a soft disclosure of that, in that the CNSA 2.0 timeline and other guidance from the federal government saying that we need to be prepared for quantum computers to be a thing, and we need to be prepared by a certain date. And the date they give are essentially 2030 to 2035 timeframe.
Okay, based on your understanding, your research, if you were to say, hey, we want to be very conservative here and not just trust 2030, 2035, when would you say, hey, this is really when we need to roll out quantum resistance in Bitcoin?
I mean, the sooner the better. The thing is, this is sovereign this is not sovereign computing. This is actually like this is quantum computing is spook computing, and so like we don't really know fully their capabilities, and even if they were capable, they wouldn't necessarily present that fact to the public, you know, immediately, right? Like, and so I think it doesn't hurt to be prudent, but also that said, it would help if we had better solutions, because right now, like the state of post-quantum cryptography, which is essentially the shield against the sword of quantum computing, right? Post-quantum cryptography or PQC is not ideal, and there's a number of reasons for that. There's ultimately we have to have a harder problem for quantum computers we have to make it hard for them, right? For any attacker. And so a crypto system must be, it must be above a certain level of complexity for it to be viable. So the signature algorithms that we have access to and we're working with now are not, they're not as good as what we have right now in terms of elliptic curve cryptography, in terms of speed or size of either the signatures and sometimes also the public keys. And so there's also concerns about adopting new security assumptions, such as lattice cryptography. I think those concerns might be valid. And so I think it might be prudent to focus initially, at least, on adding only hash-based cryptography to Bitcoin. Even though it will make the signatures much larger, and that's more expensive, it'll always be optional, at least in the way that we expect to deploy BIP360, which is BIP360 we developed it in the way it is, which is essentially fixing a problem with taproot addresses, so that we can have optionality on when you go to spend from your wallet, you get to choose whether you want to use classical cryptography, which is cheaper but potentially more vulnerable, and post-quantum cryptography, which allows you to publicly broadcast that transaction to the broader network. And
So for example, if you had like a very small amount of Bitcoin sitting in one of these wallets, you might say, I'm going to save on network fees.
Yeah.
If quantum gets me, then so be it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're holding your entire net worth, a substantial amount of Bitcoin, you opt to pay the higher fee in order to protect yourself.
Exactly. And also it also just gives people the optionality in the case that we do the work and being prudent and we all upgrade, and then it never happens because quantum computers are just like some kind of impossible thing for us to achieve for some reason. I think that, you know, like one thing I heard recently was that quantum computing is an engineering problem now. There are no serious roadblocks, and if we don't develop quantum computers within 50 years, then it will be as a result of the fact that our civilization has collapsed. And what's interesting about that, when I think about that, is that that reminds me a little bit of like kind of like the many worlds interpretation of the idea that we only exist in the universe in which we can observe it. And so like our consciousness kind of the wave function collapses in such a way that makes it more likely that you will experience a universe in which you can observe it in, right? And so as a result, we might have this sort of like confirmation bias of in this universe, certain things look like they work really well, such as mutual assured destruction, in which we are supposed to destroy the entire planet and make it basically unlivable for the vast majority of the people on it if we ever attack another nation with nuclear weapons. And so to us, it looks that mutual assured destruction works really well, but there's probably an infinite number of universes out there in which we've destroyed the whole planet. And so, but we don't experience those universes because we're not alive in which to see it. And so to us, it looks like mutual assured destruction has led us to a time of unprecedented peace. And I think similarly, I think quantum computing and Bitcoin are both things that are necessary for us to develop and move forward as a civilization. Quantum computing in particular, I think, will be important because if the reports that the UFO presence is real, then we're basically an open book to these creatures. Like, we're barely aware of their presence, much less, you know, capable of keeping secrets from them, from their vastly superior technology. And if you can't keep secrets from someone, then you sort of don't have like sort of a like the state secrets privilege, right? You don't have like necessarily the capability to exercise your own self-sovereignty in a way, right? And so they probably don't see us as peers as a result of our, even us not having like computers that are equivalent to theirs. And so that I think will be perhaps a civilizational imperative, is to be able to keep secrets from aliens. And so there's a possibility that Bitcoin was given to us by aliens. I've written about this in my blog. Satoshi, I think it was Bitcoin is a great filter. And I basically think that, you know, there's a possibility that they've observed us making the same mistake throughout his civilization many times in debasing the currency. And it must be so frustrating to have a system that works for millions of years and see these, you know, primitive uplifted apes, you know, keep making the same mistake over and over again. And eventually we reached a certain period of technological development that maybe some rogue, you know, agent was like, okay, we need to kind of give them like this technology, right? Prometheus, Enki. We have lots of myths around, you know, technological development from creatures or beings that are higher than us. And so, which is also interesting. And so this regardless, what's really interesting to me is that the initial Bitcoin Core client, well, they didn't call it Bitcoin Core. It was just the Bitcoin client. When Satoshi submitted that to the mailing list back in 2009, January, it exists the capability to receive two public key hashes, and but he didn't make it so that the initial mining rewards would go to public key hashes. They would instead go to expose public keys, and I just think that's a really interesting design decision, given the impact that would eventually have, and that. By having because the thing is, in the first 4 years of Bitcoin's existence, half the supply was mined. That's 10.5 million coins, and so there was definitely a high possibility of lost coins. People wouldn't realize necessarily its value early on, and so there might have been a certain logic in terms of like maybe Satoshi wanted us to recover those somehow, and so. In early versions of the Bit360, I wrote about a concept I like to think about as Satoshi's shield. And so I think that, you know, those early coins essentially serve as a sort of like cover for people who have less than 50 Bitcoin in their wallets to migrate to like better cryptography without necessarily needing to like be very prepared in advance. Essentially, and that's because the initial block reward is 50 Bitcoin, And it was always to a new key every time, which was interesting too, because it's not all in one place, essentially. It's not all behind one key. There's 1.7 million paid to public key coins, and that's spread across 34,000 addresses with an average balance of 50 Bitcoin each.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, well, there are a lot of threads I could pull on here. Can you elaborate a bit on BIP360? So what is it you've been working on? What does it solve? I know one of the concerns anyone has with a change or any sort of proposal to Bitcoin are, what are the unintended consequences? I'm confident you've thought through that, not to say that there couldn't be, but like, what's been the process? What does it accomplish? And how do you think about those?
So what's neat about BIP360 is that it doesn't really add anything terribly new to Bitcoin. In fact, it disables an existing feature in Taproot. In particular, it disables what's called the key path spend. And so Taproot addresses, when you spend from them, you do get the choice of essentially spending. A Taproot address essentially is an internal key that's been derived from your wallet in sort of like the traditional way that hierarchical deterministic wallets work, as defined by BIP32. And you then use what's called BIP86 derivation path to create an keys that your wallet will then create. So you'll have this internal key, and then you'll have alongside it essentially so the internal key is used for the key for the key path spend, but then there's this other mechanism called the script path, which is the script path is essentially a Merkle tree of sort of like alternative scripts. It's a Merkle binary tree. And so basically you can derive like thousands of potential possible scripts that you would expect to spend from. And eventually when you select from one, you provide the Merkle path to it, which is, for like 1,000 scripts, like the 1,000 script would require like maybe 10 32 byte hashes, so like 320 bytes total in the control block that would then allow people to spend from that particular script so far down in that Merkle alternative script tree. And so that's kind of like a high level explanation of how Taproot works. And it gets pretty in depth, and the BIPs are difficult to read because they're highly technical. But that said, to tie the explanation, to simplify it, Taproot addresses have two ways to spend from them. There's the key path spend, which requires an elliptic-curve public key. And then that gets tweaked with a script path spend hash commitment that commits to the Merkle root of the tree of potential scripts that you could use. And so what we did with BIP360 is we're proposing a new address output type that essentially evolves Taproot to the next version. And then when people go to use that specific new type of address, they will only be able to spend for it with a script path spend and not with the elliptic curve cryptography. And so that said, we're not sunsetting elliptic curve cryptography either. We're just moving it to a different part, which is a hash commitment to a script that when you go to spend that... That's pretty complicated, actually. But essentially, we do want to essentially design it so that we're not actually sunsetting elliptic curve cryptography either in the script commitment, because it's just so inexpensive. Like, it's smaller, much smaller in comparison. It's like a drop in the bucket. And so there's no reason to not use it, even if there is like a quantum break somehow. And that's because we don't want to ever like have a reduction in security in things that we think we know already work well. And so, so that's all Bit360 currently does is it fixes that problem in Taproot that there's a dependency on elliptic curve cryptography. And so on public keys. And so in the address. And so we get rid of that. And that's not adding really anything new other than just making a new address output type that has something like a whole conditional block disabled essentially or not used. And so it's not like we're adding substantial amounts of code to Bitcoin for Bit360 alone. That said, in past versions of Bit360, we explored all these different other signature algorithm types, and then we realized that all needs to go into separate BIPs. And it's just like a consequence of us going through the review process with other very talented and established core devs. And essentially, we needed to break it up because it would just be way too hard to review, and we needed to make sure all the concerns are well separated, and that way we can sort of address them separately. And that also makes it more modular too. So there's no like one, you know, single prescriptive update necessarily that makes Bitcoin quantum secure. Instead, it will be a series of updates, I think, that will make Bitcoin more quantum resistant. And so I think it's a tall order to make Bitcoin perfect. But that doesn't have to be perfect to replace all money. You know, like it just needs to be, you know, resistant against nation state attackers. And I think we should definitely like err on the side of caution in that one, right? Like because like essentially like Bitcoin's whole purpose is to essentially make it that so that any single nation state, including the issuer of the global reserve, incapable essentially of creating a better money, right? It's in a way like Bitcoin is a challenge to nation state sovereignty and their capability to issue currency, because it is showing people what a good money can be. And eventually I think people just get sick of trusting the government to have the fiscal responsibility not to overspend and deficit spend and also just not like create all this credit. And when we're working at that level, we need to absolutely prioritize the risk that nation states will intervene and try to co-opt or control this currency that essentially is a challenge to their hegemony.
Yeah, I completely agree. My take at this point is there's no real political threat to Bitcoin so long as it stays sufficiently decentralized. We've got lots of hash rate online, those things. I think that the threats that loom in the future are technical. And, I'm not going to, you know much better than I do. I'm not going to pretend to understand where we're at in terms of quantum. But to me, it seems like that is probably one of the biggest existential threats, to the extent there is one. So Bit360. One other question I had for you. For non-Taproot addresses, you go, like older wallets, like what's the impact of quantum on those? You know,
generally? It's a lot harder for quantum computers to pose a threat to those kind of addresses. It's a completely separate algorithm, has terrible scaling properties. Some people have joked that it would require a quantum computer the size of the moon to attack a 256-bit hash. So hash cryptography is considered much more resistant to quantum computers than elliptic curve cryptography for signatures.
Okay. So if you're sitting like if you're using SegWit, you're probably more quantum resistant, but in the future there are benefits to migrating to Taproot beyond security. Well, that
there's the one problem with Segwit addresses is just that if there is like an active threat on the network, eventually you will need to upgrade because it'll be more complicated because every time you spend your coins, you need to provide your public key. And so what I like about native Segwit addresses is just that they are protected. They don't have your coins generally exposed behind a public key unless you've reused that address, essentially like receive funds to it and use the same address when you've already spent from it. That is essentially I just reuse. There's other scenarios that don't necessarily expose your public key, but that particular one does. And so it's difficult because you have to really truly understand the UTXO model and how HD wallets work to get an understanding of what's safe and what's not. And or we could just activate post-quantum cryptography like SLHDSA, which we believe is sort of the gold standard in signature algorithms in terms of security assumptions, not necessarily in terms of speed or size, but definitely in terms of security. That's because we can base them on SHA-2. And I think there's plenty of juice in SHA-2. I think it's going to be safe for a long time. But that's just my opinion. And I could be wrong. But I would say that if SHA-2 is compromised, we have a lot bigger problems in Bitcoin than if SECP256K1 is compromised, which is the elliptic curve that's used by Bitcoin.
Right. Okay. So I think the other pushback people have when they hear about the quantum threat is they're like, yeah, but you know, is Bitcoin going to be the least of your worries because bank accounts and all of these sort of legacy systems whose security are built pre-quantum, everything's going to blow up. To me, that's no excuse for complacency. I mean, I think we still proceed as you've sort of described here. But in a world where, you know, we find out tomorrow, quantum's way further advanced. The government's been keeping the secret as I would anticipate them doing, regardless of when it becomes viable as an attack. Is the whole world just in a lot of trouble in that scenario? And well, Bitcoin's just a bit of the collateral damage?
No, actually, the thing that people miss when they say stuff like that is the central banks and any bank can essentially rewrite their ledger in response to an attack like that, right? Like they get to benefit from a mutable ledger, and they get to benefit from centralized control and authority and essentially all the money in the world in which they can use to spend to fix the security of their systems. And so they can hire experts, and they don't need to plan ahead necessarily, but they are already, and they're doing that. There's FinCEN guidance now actually about this threat. And they have a really solid plan, and they've spent a lot of money and a lot of time in response to the federal directives to make sure their systems are quantum resistant by a certain date. And so, I think they're going to be fine. I think remember what happened to the Russian oligarchs after Putin invaded Ukraine, right? Basically, SWIFT, you know, was considered neutral technology, but they rewrote the ledger in response to that concern, and that essentially compromised SWIFT's neutrality, perception of neutrality and trustworthiness to wealthy private individuals. And so, yeah, I mean, of course they're going to just like bend the rules for how they like to, you know, operate things. And so that's not the case with Bitcoin. And that's what makes Bitcoin so valuable, right? Is that we can't just like upgrade it willy-nilly. We need to put a lot of work into essentially making sure it's any change to it is thoroughly vetted and well considered, and we've considered all possibilities and alternatives, and so that's you know, like I've been working on BitB60 for it's coming on, I think, 18 months now. And it's taken that much work. And I have a whole team now working on this solution. It's sponsored by Ondro, which is a sidechain platform that is incubated by Mara. And Mara is the largest single Bitcoin miner, probably, unless you maybe think of Bitmain. I don't know. I don't know. But it's one of the largest. We have 5% of the hash rate. And the reason why I thought it made a lot of sense for me to partner my work with their technology is that they have enough hash rate to operate a private mempool service, and that will be essential for bridging it, like creating like a quantum resistant bridging protocol. Because remember, when we have to like expose your public key whenever you spend something, what you can do is you can take that to a private mempool, and they will hold on to that in private. So it'll only be just one party instead of all the tens of thousands of nodes out there that would know about your transaction. And eventually it'll wind up in a block without having its public key exposed beforehand. And so I think that's going to be crucial during the transitionary period. And so that's why I think it makes a lot of sense to leverage that to the fullest extent on sidechain platforms like Ondro to give us sort of a safe place to put our coins in advance.
So maybe I don't understand the tech well enough, but to me, so and I hear you that you're indicating this is like a transitionary period, because to me that sounds like a centralizing concern of like a breach, or to where, you know, one exposure, you know, then we, you know, the fact that we really need quantum resistance because you haven't achieved security. Do you view that to be like truly a transitionary period where they're offering a service that people find useful until, you know, we can transact publicly through the node? Because,
well, so I think sidechains will still be useful for scaling even after. Everybody's kind of transitioned their coins, and there's like a new equilibrium, right? Like a new sort of security model for Bitcoin that has to take into account the fact that public key cryptography is not going to be reliable as a security assumption. If that's the case, then it's kind of like back to the drawing board for a lot of protocols. Anything using Snarks, for example, would be impacted greatly. Anything using Taproot and not BIP 360 addresses would be a problem as well. And so
So a world where BIP 360 has been adopted fully, people begin to onboard and utilize that new technology, probably obsoletes the need for some of what you've described, but there could still be demand for it in certain instances. And, you know, but hopefully over time, it, you know, because what I hear is, and this is, I want to talk briefly on knots versus core, because my sense is, regardless of like the relay policy and the division there, there's also like a division in the significance of running a node. And like we're big proponents of running a node, and like I want the network to, you know, I want Slipstream, for example, to be like a small minority of transactions that people generally operate through the Bitcoin network at large.
Yeah.
I think that's key to decentralization, and without decentralization, you know, obviously, I think we could run into issues. I don't have a specific question. Maybe if you want to comment on
I mean, like
am I missing something?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, like Slipstream is not going to be like how we solve, you know, the problem of certainly not like scaling Bitcoin, right? Because it's only 5% of the blocks anyway, and so. Basically, and also Slipstream is heavily moderated. Like it is like if you want to bypass the rules of the network, of the peer-to-peer network, then you can absolutely take your transaction directly to a miner, but you will, like, that miner will also heavily vet that transaction, hopefully, as well. And so I mean, like, it is somewhat of a centralizing force, I would say. But that said, it's not meant to be like the solution. It's meant to be an interim solution for the solution, right? And so where we can field the technology and test it with real money and like sort of prove that there is demand before there is like an activation on the network. And look, Bitcoin is incredibly difficult to change and for good reason. And I remember back in June of 2024 when I was first looking into this problem in a serious way. There were no BIPs and there were no really discussions around this at that time. And so I resigned myself to the fact that I would need to write a BIP and that I might have to be someone involved in a soft fork of Bitcoin. And even a soft fork is, oh yeah. And like committing to that, like, was almost a bit of like a, like horrifying to me. And so it's just a huge responsibility, and I've had to put my life on hold. I would love to, you know, participate in all this cool AI stuff that's happening, because I think that's fascinating. But that said, I've sort of taken on as a responsibility the sort of like, just some people call me, you know, the Bitcoin Greta, right? Like, you know, like, look, how dare you not take the quantum threat seriously, you know? And I'm okay in that role. I'm fine with it because, you know, it's something that needs to be done, and it could potentially take a long time, which is fine with me, right? Like, I'm not trying to rush anything. I want us to have the ideal solution so that we can push back against all the, just all the bad stuff that comes from state meddling in money.
Yeah. No, I hear you on that. So what's been the reception of BIP360 amongst the people smart enough to understand what it's doing? Is there pushback? Like, what's the rollout period if this were to, you know, to be activated?
It has been a number of just small little points, nitpicks, and that sort of thing. And so we've done our best to address every concern, and I've also brought on some friends to help. And so Ethan Heilman is my second co-author, and he brought years of experience in protocol development, and he's a cryptographer, which is like a professionally trained cryptographer. With a PhD, which I do not have, unfortunately. I honestly don't believe in credentialism, and I don't think it's like a lot of what's taught at schools is very useful. But that said, that would be one of the degrees I think would have been nice. But regardless, it's nice to have Ethan Hallman's help. And also we have Isabel Fox and Duke now. So she has rewritten the BIP entirely from a clean sheet to make it more clear. And that work is sitting in a pull request that I just need. I'm hoping I can hit the button on that today to merge it. And when I do that, then I have to, that kicks off like a whole chain of events we've planned on communicating the rewrite, to reviewers. And, there's like, you know, the Bitcoin Core Devs mailing list, which is on, Google now. And, there's also a Delving Bitcoin, which is also an important place to discuss changes to Bitcoin. So we'll be hitting those, and then also Exit and Noster. And I'm not the biggest fan of Noster for communications around this particular threat, because it is like every Noster identity is it's a public key, and so there could be a potential future in which, you know, my public key is compromised through no fault of my own, and somebody could try to publish nonsense. And so that's something that I want to make sure is clear about Noster. Like I have my hands full with Bitcoin, and I would love to, you know, be the author of that NIP, but it's going to need to be somebody else, because but they will need to adopt post-quantum cryptography, and until they do, it's going to always be sort of second fiddle to the centralized solutions like X for social, because those get to rewrite their ledger, right? They get to play by sort of the authoritarian rules, right? Whereas like Noster, like there's no single ledger. It's based on a system of relays, and so that's incredibly different. It's and I love that. You know, I love the idea of being censorship resistant. We need to like definitely maximize that consideration in the face of threat actors. But that said, I also do get the concerns from the Knots crowd. You know, like on arbitrary data. Look, if I thought arbitrary data was a threat to Bitcoin, I would be on their side. I don't think that is. I think that I just can't think. Despite you know my trying, it's hard for me to. It's hard for me to take the concern seriously because I don't think they have merit.
Mm-hmm.
But I do understand where they're coming from because we have certain shared sets of values, right? We are Bitcoiners, and I do believe Bitcoin is money, but I believe it's programmable money, and that serves a useful purpose. And they're, you know, like, well, you know, like timestamping is one thing that's really valuable. Timestamping of data off chain, right? That's like Giacomo Zucco, Nuts van Holm. We've had conversations about this a lot, and they're fine with that, right? I think the disagreement is on, like, you know, maybe sort of like archival use cases or non-monetary use cases. That is complicated because, like, you know, I've spoken to Nat a lot about this and Giacomo, and I love both those guys. And you know, like they've explained to me that putting arbitrary data on the network on people's nodes is essentially, although it's a small violation of the NAP, it's still a violation of the NAP. They see it as sort of like littering on someone's private property, essentially. And I mean, I get that concern to a degree. I need to think about it a lot more, though, honestly. And I don't want to like say that, you know, like, I don't want to completely discount the concern, because, you know, I want to take every threat to Bitcoin seriously.
Is your base case that the reason arbitrary data is not a concern to you is just because it will be priced out as Bitcoin continues to monetize, and you've got bigger institutions who are leveraging it as a form of money and transacting, you know, in terms of,
well, there's definitely like a perspective that fees are the best filter. I think that's a good point, I guess, but it doesn't really like put the discussion at bed, right? Like, you know, there's like, you know, the concern of CSAM or other things that people might not want, like such as like an image of the Prophet Muhammad and that sort of thing. I mean, I think in that regard, it's a matter of like sort of like engineering and architecture of distributed systems. You need to prioritize certain things, and I think Bitcoin placed a priority on censorship resistance far more than that it did against the threat of harmful arbitrary data. And I think there aren't a lot of technical threats that come to Bitcoin through this way. And so that also makes it more difficult for me to evaluate, because like then it becomes like a bit of like a social threat, right? And like that's a lot more nebulous and difficult to unravel. But what I can say is that there is a concern about the length, not of operturn, but of the script pub key, which the operturn is one of many opcodes that can go into the script pub key in an output. And I think That is one thing I would support, one aspect of BIP444 that I would support. I think we need to restrict the length of the script hub key, which would, by extension, severely limit OpReturn, unless this is like also like a carve out consideration for OpReturn, which I think also BIP444 has. It's just, but we need to dramatically restrict, I think, what can go in there, or at least how many opcodes, how many bytes can go into the script hub key. And the reason for that is because if it's even at the limit, which it is now. Which is essentially almost a megabyte. If you could put like a megabyte of signature verification opcodes, you can essentially create this like this algorithm that scales quadratically, and it uses a very like computationally intensive opcode that is limited usually, but the limit is just not enough, even in Rayleigh policy. To make this a problem because so the Rayleigh policy limit is actually okay, but if you bypass that limit and you take it directly to a miner, Slipstream definitely looks for these kind of things because it's designed by Portland Hoddle, and he also is calling attention to the problem of what he calls DOS blocks and like denial of service blocks, a block with a transaction that is so large and complicated for the node to verify, it could take 30 minutes on a decent computer to verify that block. And then you get to a point where like, okay, well then what if every subsequent block, you know, takes three times longer to verify than usual, that becomes a big problem. And so I think that we should absolutely, you know, take steps to mitigate the threat of not necessarily arbitrary data, but like attacks like a DOS block could be devastating. And like we have to remember, like we have an obligation for this to be an immutable ledger, and for us to like it becomes really problematic to maintain that when IBD, you know, slowed down, you know, by such a degree. And so, you know, like I think we need to take that concern seriously, but you know, like that's probably like the furthest I would take it. As far as like, you know, OpReturn, it's technically the least impactful transaction type on a node. It doesn't go into the UTXO set database, and it doesn't benefit from the witness discount, and so these bytes are not discounted. They're not denser transactions. Like even your ordinary SegWit, like BCNQ address, creates a denser transaction than an OpReturn would. And so OpReturns kind of displace denser transactions on nodes as a result. And so you know, like I don't see the concern around that. There are, you know, like people have raised like the concern of, you know, arbitrary data in which they're consecutive bytes, I guess. And like they're not, there's no like a separator between them. And so that does obfuscate them. The thing about that is, you know, I mean, like that might be the case for the data structure, but on disk, like, you know, I mean, it depends on your threat model, but like in more recent versions of the Bitcoin Core, by default, it will encrypt obfuscate, let's just say that, using XOR, which is just a simple mathematical operation, will obfuscate the bytes on disk for both the level DB and the, which contains the UTXO set, and also the blocks themselves, the block.dat files on your node. So, you know, like if you're worried about there being bytes on disk with arbitrary data that contain, you know, viruses or CSAM or other things, like you don't need to worry so much because the XOR essentially like turns those bytes completely different. And it's a fast operation to decode that, but it does obfuscate it to the point where those bytes are not, when they're on disk, they are.
You're not storing CSAM per se. Right. Because against the bytes themselves have been, you can unwind into it, but okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I guess I have one last question for you on this. So I'll express the concern I've had, and this could be a matter of perception or perhaps a matter of misunderstanding as to how historically this has gone. When it comes to the Knots Core thing, I'm a Bitcoin is money guy. I run Knots not because I necessarily, unless we get 9900% of nodes running Knots, mm-hmm. I don't think it necessarily fixes anything.
Like, even if we had 100% of people running Knots, people could still bypass that by going to the miner.
Correct. For me, what it's been is my perception is this: the OpReturn change was a highly controversial change to the reference implementation of Bitcoin, and it felt to me as I look on X as though it was brushed off, kind of a middle finger given to all the people saying we don't want this, and they pushed it through anyway. And my concern isn't necessarily, I think this could be consequential. I don't think it is to some of the points you've made. But what stops, you know, Core 31, Core 32, any other from Core somewhat unilaterally deciding here's what we're going to do? They've learned that with Core 30, they can kind of push it forward, and it doesn't really matter if everyone on X is screaming at them and saying we don't want this. Doesn't matter if other implementations are gaining popularity because, you know, of a perceived violation of their trust, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
What would you say to that? Is that a misperception on my part, or is that a valid concern that I have?
Well, look, it is such a complicated problem, right? Like the concept of rough consensus. And I don't want to disparage node choice by any means, right? Like, I think that's an important thing. And to encourage node runners and node adoption, and a lot of that comes from the Knots side, which is great to see. Really, and I'm very supportive of that. And I'm I have several Start 9 nodes. I was a big fan of them, at least until their CEO told me to fuck off several times. But it kind of hurt actually a bit, because you know. We're in the same town, and we see each other sometimes, and we go way back. But eventually, I called out that, you know, his company is essentially it didn't look to me like the rhetoric around this issue was neutral. It was quite biased. And also, like, Parman, you know, like was very transparent about his own biases. And so look, I'm fine with, you know, people being honest and genuine, but I think Start 9 should have been held to a higher standard. By the way, I also have a Parma node, and I'm a big fan of his work, and even though we disagree a little bit on certain things, you know, we're generally quite respectful towards each other. So regardless of, you know, the drama there, you know, it's not really much of like substance. It's something I will admit, you know, like, I've lost a lot of friends due to this controversy, and it hurts, and it darkens the soul in many ways. And it makes me wonder, you know, is this a psyop? Like, are the people pushing for this feds somehow? That's like a thing that enters my mind just because of how dark it's gotten, and like where they go in their arguments, especially like CSAM is an interesting argument, right? From a perspective of like, are these people feds? Well, like, well, they're going to call the FBI on you for running a node that has CSAM on it. And I'm just like, well, interesting. You know, like, look, I don't know. I personally find Mechanic his work to be quite valuable. I like Datum a lot. I like that he's tried to solve the problem of distributing mining rewards via Lightning in Bolt 12. That is so cool, even though it doesn't necessarily work really well, because, you know, but Lightning is payment channels, and so they're like solving the problem of Lightning or of mining pool payouts, which usually unidirectional, right? For that to, like, for him to try to solve that problem, I think is very cool. And I told him that, and I'm appreciative of his work. But that said, I think it is, it's weird where, the Knots rhetoric has gone. It's gotten hyperbolic, and also in many ways, I find the comments made towards Gloria Xiao to be particularly offensive. Because I've seen her work. I've seen she is an incredibly talented and hardworking developer who has earned her place in her role. And I thought that was just really tasteless, and sad that, people would accuse her of not having earned that position through merit. So, like Truck V3 and, the anchor, pay to anchor, all that is her work. And that was a ton of work. And so, I don't know.
I think the thing that we can agree on is like the rhetoric is unhelpful. And I think there is, again, I'm running Knots for my own reason. And I think there's a case that both sides could make for your question, is this a PSYOP? The reality is, my position is, if you're not going to run Knots, if you're unsure about what to do, run Core 30, run Core 29. In the meantime, I don't think there's any harm in that. And my hope is that moving forward, it'll be, and any changes that are controversial will be more clearly articulated. Will be I know it's easy to yell at each other on X. It's a lot harder to sit down and have that conversation more productive, because no one talks to each other that way in real life, right? It's easy when you're sitting behind a keyboard. But
I will absolutely admit that I think Core may have been wrong to try to push that change forward, as controversial as it was. The problem is raising the op return limit. It's such or what they call the data carrier size, right?
It's trivial.
Yeah. And so to somebody who understands Bitcoin at a technical level, but not necessarily you also don't want to acquiesce to the mob, right? Like, that's also an attack vector of Bitcoin, right? Like we've seen this before too with the block size wars and how vitriolic that got. And I think Bitcoin suffers to this day from sort of the hit to adoption that happened when we realized it couldn't scale and on the base layer. And if we wanted to increase that scale through a block size increase, that would result in essentially a hard fork of the rules behind Bitcoin, which would essentially be a no-go. A hard no for a certain subset of Bitcoiners. And so that, the flip side is, Bitcoin was used by Newegg and Dell and also Steam. You could buy Steam games with Bitcoin at one point. And so and we've lost that. And I don't know when that'll ever come back. I think we'll need that as we transition away from using the dollar as our principal unit of account in our daily lives, because I think that is a mathematical inevitability, that the debt spiral, we are locked into that, especially with the one big beautiful bill that Trump likes so much. And I'm not bleeding heart liberal, I myself am a Trump voter, and me and my husband. And we both realized this nonsense needs to stop. We're hoping, at least one party at least pays lip service to fiscal responsibility. But then, of course, the one big beautiful bill locked us into $2 trillion of deficit spending every year for the next decade, which, of course, it sucks, because $1 trillion of that is our debt payment. And so we're paying debt with more debt, and that's not sustainable. And we need to Bitcoin is the lifeboat, right? We need to take our role as Bitcoiners very fucking seriously, because, if we don't get to rely on that exorbitant privilege, there will be a breakdown in the social contract that will be very difficult to get through. And I think the only way we get through that without like a civil war or mass civil unrest is just being really smart about how we decide to run our economy. And I think the Austrians will have the last laugh eventually. It's just a mathematical inevitability that we're heading for, essentially. Some call it like an eschatology of hyper-Bitcoinization. Like they put like religious terms on it. Nick Carter once described it as that. I think we have deleted the tweet in which we said that, though, which I think is also kind of funny. There is sort of like a religious or otherworldly importance to Bitcoin when you get to understand it. And I will also say that it's one of the things that keeps me sane, the fact that we have that, right? Like the lifeboat, because the plan B, because if we didn't have Bitcoin, man, I would be so black-pilled, especially knowing everything I know now. And I wouldn't know everything I would know now because I wouldn't give myself permission to learn how fucked the system is if we didn't have a solution. And so like Bitcoin sort of like gives you like permission to learn about like how banking works, how money works throughout history. And it really is like an amazing lens to view the world through. And if we don't have it, we are so fucked. And as a result, that's why I not only dedicated my career to working on it, but to also resolving one of the larger existential threats to it.
Yeah. And for that, I'm grateful. And I appreciate your time. I got one last question for you. The one I ask everyone at the end of the episode: what is an unpopular opinion you have? Bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it.
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. I wish I had thought about that a little bit more, but I think like maybe the biggest unpopular opinion is, that comes to mind that's most like obvious is, look, Bitcoin doesn't care about you. Like it doesn't need you. It doesn't need your individual help. That's true. But also it is designed in a sort of meritocracy. I believe the process is meritocratic because I've gone through it. And although I haven't, been able to achieve activation of any of this work, I think would be the ultimate test. I still have faith that the system works as it should. And so we just need to get through this process of rough consensus in a distributed system, which is very complicated. In solving this very difficult problem, and it's very nebulous and very spooky, which sucks because, like, it would really be nice if, like, the person who will break Bitcoin will tell us first, right? But we don't have that guarantee. And so as a result, we just need to do our best to get ahead of this concern. And as a result, we'll put the FUD to bed and then we'll just move on with our lives, hopefully. And, maybe Bitcoin needs me for like this small period of time and then we can move on and I can retire and work on cool things that could accelerate hyper Bitcoinization with AI or something, and I've thought a lot about like maybe food delivery service or something that could be useful. But
I hope you have that opportunity because I appreciate the work that you're doing right now on, I think, an important security issue, one that is, I think, certainly top of mind for many people. It's one of the points of FUD that scares people away. So yeah. I'm grateful for that. And I hope once this is sorted out and in the very near future, you have the opportunity to pursue whatever else has been on your mind for the last couple of years.
Yeah. Thank you.
Terrific. Well, Hunter, thank you so much for your time today, man. Really appreciate it. And why don't you give a quick handoff, tell people where they can find you, learn more about BIP360, follow you, anything else?
Yes. So BIP360.org is where you're going to want to go to find the latest on the BIP that we've been working on. And hopefully we'll have the latest draft up soon, very soon, probably by the time you publish this. Dude, it's been really busy lately, just trying to coordinate everything and button up every little last detail. And also you can find me on x.com/CryptoQuick and then also on Noster. My NPUB is NPUB1QQQ. There's a lot of Qs, and then there's like a bunch of numbers. Yeah.
Well said. People will find you there.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, Hunter, thanks for the time, man. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
Happy. Yeah. Thank you.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Hunter. I know I had a blast, learned a lot. This is not a topic I knew much about coming in, but make sure you go follow Hunter on X, find him on Noster, and of course, check out BIP 360 to learn a bit more about it. I'll link to all of that in the description. And of course, if you need help taking your Bitcoin into proper 100% self-custody, running a node, we can help you. Go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We can also help you with personal cybersecurity, set up a privacy phone. We've got a Plan B residency option, a whole host of services related to Bitcoin. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast to schedule your free call. And of course, if you're enjoying the channel, do me a huge, huge favor. Give us a like, subscribe, comment, share it with someone who you think might be interested in it. We'd really appreciate that. It helps feed the algorithm and send the signal out into the world. And until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.